Force the mind to work, yes, that aspect. What are you going to say?
Split relationship is started from contradiction.
Yes, rasa comes out of contradiction. Right? Because here you have the principle. You have God, you have this creation. Contradictory elements. Right? He is stable, he is steady. And the energy is unstable and unsteady without its connection to him. Does that make sense? So that means all these contradictions, everything becomes perfect when it's connected to Krishna. So it's very important. Human life means contradiction. Right? Demigod life, then not as much contradiction there. Right? But Krishna is not living the lifestyle of demigods. He's living the lifestyle of humans. There's more rasa there. Right? Does that make sense? There's more things that can happen and go. Demigods is just always nice. Right? You know, you always look good, you never get any old. It's all like that. There's no change. As soon as you're born, you grow up, you're full grown. Like that. Don't have to worry about, you know, parenting the kids and all, changing diapers. None of that. You know, it's just, you know, out the window. So it's just all nice. Like that. But in that niceness, so-called perfection, so many aspects of rasa in their intensity and fullness are lost. Therefore, the human life, it's because it's full of contradiction, that's what makes it interesting. That's what creates the variety. Because you have to remember, Krishna is going to be around eternally. That means he's got to be doing something eternally, so there should be some variety. Right? Vaikuntha, of course, is variety. But it's not the kind of variety that catches this mind. Right? Remember before is that it was pointed out that Krishna is not captured by the awe and reverence of the residents of Vaikuntha. Right? It doesn't make him submissive. It doesn't capture his mind. But the activities of the friends and the parents and lovers in Vrindavan does. Why? Because it's completely contradictory. Here's God, you know, Lord of everything, and now these people are saying they're controlling him. Right? And they're doing that just as if it's a taken fact. So all these things, this is what creates and generates the rasa. Is that understood? So contradiction is important that we learn that it's something we have to deal with. So I've heard devotees say that because a verse can be used to prove so many contradictory points, they have a tendency to not accept Shastra. Right? You have two parties opposing on a view, and they both use the same verse to establish their point of view. Right? So the problem is not that you can do that. The problem is, why would you give up faith in the Vedas because of that? Right? Because ultimately everything is coming from Krishna. So the farther it expands from Krishna, the more you have contradiction. But it's come from Krishna. So if it's touching Krishna, there's not a problem. Now the point is which of these contradictory views that are both supported by the same verse is actually appropriate and applicable to the time, place, and circumstance? That's the consideration. Not that it's contradictory. It's which of these two contradictions is the one to use now. Because at a different time, it changes. What you would use now, then you wouldn't use the contradiction to it. But in another situation, you wouldn't use what you were using now, you'd use what was the seeming contradiction. Does that make sense? So that's what needs to be learned by the Veda. Not that it's just blatant and clear. Like, you know, why do I have to do Guru Puja? Like that. And then what is expected? We have to pull a verse out of the Shastra that says, you know, on Monday morning at 7:30, then Bhakta Jose is supposed to come with lamp, you know, made out of brass, bought in Vrindavan and Loy Bazaar, and then some camphor. But, you know, if he doesn't have the natural camphor, he can use the artificial camphor, and all these different things, you know. And then if it says that, then I'll go, yes, this is truth. But if it just says that one perfection of life is by worshipping the spiritual master, and only through him can you attain whatever desires you want to fulfill, then they'll say, but that doesn't say you have to do puja. You understand? That's a problem. Like that. That's a problem. So one has to be able to understand the context and everything that is being spoken in. Then it becomes very powerful, because time, place, and circumstance has to be applied. Right? So Krishna just naturally, he's created everything, and so the shastras are based on how what he's created. Right? And the same time as, Krishna creates according to the Veda. Right? Krishna does everything according to the Veda, the same time as the Veda is according to everything Krishna does. So there's no contradiction. So to avoid the Veda, revile the Veda, right? To speak badly about the Veda, therefore is an offense to the holy name. And you could say, well, no, we just chant Hare Krishna, we don't care for the rules. But the holy name does, seeing that the holy name is the one that wrote the rules. Right? Because Krishna's name are non-different, therefore the name is also involved in this writing. Right? Because the Vedas is full of his names. So if you disregard the Veda, then Krishna's not very pleased. What you have to understand is, of the contradictory aspects, which one I'm supposed, what am I supposed to apply? And what am I supposed to apply right now? But there's never a thing that the Veda is wrong. Veda is never wrong. Our understanding of it, our ability to apply it to the time, place, and circumstance, that may be wrong, because as a conditioned soul, we make mistakes. But the Veda is never wrong. Does that make sense? Because if it's wrong, then why are we sitting here? You know what I'm saying? Because we're sitting here because of the concept that the material world has a problem. Right? And we're looking for solutions and we're not finding them. So in the authority of the Veda, it's saying there aren't any. The only solution is Krishna consciousness. Right? Because otherwise, if there was other solutions, then, you know, the bookshops, you know, what they have to offer on the shelves there, have the answers. Right? Because there are people who, despite all the difficulties in the material world, have answers what you could be doing. Does that make sense? But we're sitting here because of the authority of the Vedas. So we shouldn't just apply it whenever we like and not apply it when it doesn't suit us. It has to be an irrevocable fact that the Veda is authority, we accept it, now it's just a matter of how it's applied. Does that make sense? It's very important. So this is one, the first of Lord Chaitanya's, you know, 10, aphorisms of the philosophy, the Dasamul. The first is, Veda is the authority. Right? Based on that, then he has 9 other points that are made in Sambandhavideya Prayojana. But without Veda, there's no meaning. Yes?
How can we be confident that we're receiving the Vedic literatures in an uncorrupted form?
How do we be confident? That, because we, means the Vedic literatures are very vast, then from that, then we hear from the authorities, from the acharyas. So hearing from them, so you have the book Bhagavat, you have the person Bhagavat. So because the acharyas have told us of the Vedas, then these books are the most important. Why are they the most important? Because they make it the most clear and easily understandable what the Veda is actually saying. Because the Veda, when it's talking all these very technical and very poetic and very mystical kind of things, it's still meaning the same thing that the Bhagavatam is saying. Just we're not catching that. Right. So therefore, then by that authority, then so that we get the right perspective, then we hear from the acharyas. And of the acharyas, then we hear from our acharya. Right? So in practical terms, then what the purports that Prabhupada give us, from that we observe the other Vedic literatures and the writings of the acharyas. Everything's brought in line with that. Okay? Now, so therefore you don't have to worry about reading the books. Now if you're hearing about the books, then it has to be seen that what is being spoken is in line with those books and those purports. If that is, then you can be confident that what you're hearing is good. If it's not, then that's something to be looked into. Is that okay?
Should we be worried? Prabhupada's writings are changed in any way?
Should we be worried if Prabhupada's writings are changed? Means that someone wants to change them, or?
Yeah, or both. Or, you know, like I've heard devotees say that this, you know, I've seen the purport where it used to be another way.
The purport is another way. It's called editing, right? But the editing, proper editing, has to keep the meaning. What they're probably worried about is the Bhagavad Gita. Is that the original Bhagavad Gita? Then means we have to always remember that the original Bhagavad Gita is a transcript, right? Or I think Prabhupada might have even typed it himself. That would be sent for editing. So the first editor was very intelligent. You know, he was a PhD in literature. Very good at poetics, very good at language. But he was a little new to the philosophy. But the point is Prabhupada's point is, what you understand, you write. So in Prabhupada's purports, then in his original writing, because his understanding is greater, then there may be so many points that are there. The editor then reads that, what he understands of that, then he sees that that gets across. So what he's gotten across is bona fide. But it may be due to his not understanding as much, then something might have, some nuance may have been left out, or some element that could be, you know, brought out may not come there, but because he doesn't understand it or didn't even notice it existed. Does that make sense? But that doesn't change the potency of the work. This is very important. So then, that's why it says imperfectly composed, and the great personality still accepted. Now, somehow or another, the powers that be at the BBT then looked at compared the original, you know, writing with what had been edited. And they found that more could be brought out by a new editing. Like that. There were some points that, because terminologies were not necessarily known, or concepts, that certain concepts and that weren't brought out. The point is if you know one thing, you simply know Krishna's God, I'm his eternal servant, my duty is to serve him through the process of devotional service, and the ultimate goal is to please Krishna, and, you know, through the expression of love. If you only know this, and that process is through chanting, you can perfect your life. So the more you expand that, then the more aspects you have. Right? So they felt it would be wise to re-edit it, and everything that was there that Hayagriva had put remains, and then more is put in, unless there was something that he didn't understand what it was. Then they might adjust that. So then, in either case, whether you're getting more or less, it still has the same transcendental nature. Does that make sense? So we're not just dealing here with words. We're dealing with the medium of carrying the chit potency, which is actually what's spiritual. You know what I'm saying? Black and white letters, you know, black letters on a white piece of paper is not what's spiritual. It's that those black and white elements are coming in the line of parampara, therefore they have potency. You know what I'm saying? There's so many vegetables in the market. They're all the same. But the devotee goes, picks one up, takes it home, cooks it for Krishna. It's the same vegetable that the next door neighbor is cooking. But after having cooked it, then one you call transcendental and the other one you say is not. It's the same cauliflower. You know, it comes from the same, you know, how you say it? I say McDonald's garden or something, you know. Wasn't he the farmer? Old McDonald. So it's the same cauliflower, the same potato. So what's happened is it's because it's come in contact with the parampara, therefore it's able to carry the chit potency. That's what's important. So therefore, you can see it works. The original translation, people read it, they become devotees. The present one, they read it, they become devotees. So it works. So this whole thing, it has to be this or that or so many things, that's not the point. The point is that as it is, you're bringing the points out. Now, to change those because you feel that they are not politically correct, that they don't match the modern, perspective of certain groups of people, a group that has a particular interest or a particular focus and it doesn't please them, we don't rewrite the books. That's a different concept. This is a matter of editing. The other is a matter of changing. So that we avoid. But if it's a matter of by editing it, it will make it more clear, that's not a problem. Does that make sense? You know, Prabhupada spoke classes. Those classes then were written into books. So sometimes they'll edit the class. Because the spoken word and the written word, sometimes you have to present them differently. Same point, just you present them. Like when you're speaking, you can waffle like anything. And it doesn't matter. And because you're trying to get a point across. But when you're writing, you can't do that. You can just see it. Because there's no intonation of the voice, no hand gestures, no anything that will bring it out. Does that make sense? So those things you change. So nobody's complaining, oh, they edited Prabhupada's lectures and changed them. No. Because it's just putting him into a medium that you can understand. Does that make sense? And we have to remember, Prabhupada did make the statement that the devotees will write, there will be purports to his purports. So to bring them out and explain them so that persons who didn't understand the original purport can understand what he's meant by that. He didn't say, in the future, they will change my purports. No, he said, they will write purports to my purports. Is that okay?
Yeah. So does it come down to the intention of the person who's representing Prabhupada's?
The intention of the person. Yes, you could. That would be, we remember before is that Shonaka Rishi is telling Yudhishthira and Maharaj that you have work, which is important, that the work is done properly. But then you have the intention or the motive of the work. That's more important, the attitude that you have. Because if that's correct, then your work will be good, even if the skill is not so great. That's what we're saying, is that the first editor, even though he has great editing skill, he doesn't necessarily have great spiritual acumen. So, but it still worked. Because the attitude was correct. Right? Later editors, then they're able to do and they have, more experience, on the spiritual dealing, so therefore they can bring more out. But the attitude is the same. To change it because it doesn't fit how you think. That's a problem, because here it says it's contradictory. So Prabhupada says it is contradictory from the ordinary point of view. He acknowledges that. But it is not false. Right? So this is what's very, very important, is that we'll say if it's observable by the senses, then it's truth. But Prabhupada's bringing out more important is that it's supported by Shastra. That's truth. In other words, when it's connected to Krishna, that's truth. Vedic literatures are not a subject of mundane empirical research. The non-believers have not a bona fide access to the divine secrets of the Vedic texts. Bhakto sime shakacheti rahasyam yetad uttamam. Bhagavad Gita 4:3. Yeah, we always have to remember is that, this concept of the secret has been around for a long time. Although many scholars endeavor to explore the scriptures of Bharatavarsha, they often find themselves unable to even properly date them. What to speak of understanding their real meaning? It's just like, the scriptures are all all people. They're personified in the court of Brahma. And do you think any of them are going to go out to dinner with these empiric scholars? Right? Think about it. So, therefore, they can't get the proper timings and all that. Indeed, the Moris Winternitz. Moris Winternitz, one of the most respected chronologists, argues that any attempt to reconstruct the Vedic period is unscientific. He writes, "The chronology of the history of Indian literature is shrouded in truly terrifying darkness." Winternitz quotes a pioneer American Sanskritist who years ago said, quote, "All dates given in Indian literary history are pins set up to be bowled down again." This is all from readings in the Vedic literature, Satsrut Das Goswami. Right? In other words, they can't accept this because they don't have the proper faith and understanding. If they accept Veda as it is, when it says this is the time it was written, then that's the time it was done. Because they do say which one comes first, which one comes after, because there was chronology of the writing. It means all the Puranas and all the Vedic literatures are all manifest at the same time. Right? They all live simultaneously in Brahma's court. But when they were spoken to the sages at Naimisharanya, and therefore got written down, that has different times. Right? Because those are based on compilations or speaking previously. Right? Like Sutta Goswami is speaking Bhagavatam. But he's speaking about when Sukadev spoke it to Parikshit Maharaj. Right? So at a previous time. And in there, then there's conversations that go back, you know, that are recent or go back millions or billions or trillions of years. So the knowledge has always been there. Now it's just a matter of when Vyasadeva wrote it down, because in Kali Yuga, memory not being so great, then we're not going to remember it all. So it's written for our benefit. But previously, you didn't have to write it. It was just spoken. Publishing a book means you sat down and you spoke it. That was published. Right? Well, nowadays, it is... you have to actually put it on paper. Then it's published. The difficulties the scholars meet with while attempting to trace back the beginning of the Vedas are easy to explain if we are aware that the Vedas are in fact eternal. In Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 2.4.10, it is stated that Rig Yajur Sama Atharva Vedas, the Puranas and Itihasas, are the very breath of the Lord. Since the Supreme Personality of Godhead is absolute, he is identical with his breath. Consequently, the Vedas are non-different from him. Quote, "There is no difference between the Vedas and the Lord. The Vedas aim at the understanding of the Lord, and the Lord is the Vedas personified." Srimad Bhagavatam 3.1.33 purport. So the Vedas are to understand the Lord, and the Lord is the Vedas personified, so there's no contradiction. So it's always been there. When Garuda flaps his wings, then the sounds of the hymns of the Samveda manifest, right? So these things have always been there, like that. In the beginning of creation, Lord Krishna revealed the Vedas to Brahma, the first living being in the universe. Brahma handed down the divine knowledge to his mental sons, the great sages. The sages taught the same knowledge to his disciples, and in this way, the scriptures were transmitted without any change. Sometimes some parts of the scriptures get lost due to break in disciplic succession. Sakale neha mahata yoga nashta parantapa, Bhagavad Gita 4.2. They are again heard entranced by the rishis. Rishi means a seer, or one who perceives the Vedic text, mantra drishta. He hears it in trance and realizes its meaning. Thus, the Vedic sages play a crucial role for preserving the scriptures and presenting them again and again to the world. Right, so therefore, that's what you're saying, the authority, it comes down to the great personalities through the paramparas. When the Vedas are being recited, it is the tradition to mention the name of the rishi who is connected with a particular section, as well as his lineage or gotra. For instance, Agastya Mitra Varuna. Varunihi, that is Agastya, the son of Mitra Varuna, or Maruchanda Vishwamitraha, the sage Maruchanda descending from the Vishwamitra Gotra. Right? So it says here, Agastya, the son of Mitra Varuna. But Agastya is one of the sons of Brahma. So, but due to some, I think it was a curse, and he lost his body, he had to appear as the son of Mitra and Varuna. So then the Taittiriya Upanishad, which is a discussion between Agastya and Varuna. So that happened after, not when he was, known. I mean, when he was before that relation. He's still known as the son of Brahma, but same time as he appeared through Mitra and Varuna. So they always mention then the sage, because that sage is the one who became perfect by meditating upon those verses. Right? In other words, so there's one verse, and then that verse is what he meditated on and became perfect. Right? Or it's a group of verses, like depending upon how the Veda is broken up. The fact that the mantras are associated with the names of different sages does not mean that the sages themselves composed the mantras. When we say that Columbus discovered America, we do not mean that he created it. Rather, we mean that he had the continent known to... He made the continent known to the world, like that. Similarly, the Vedic seers did not create the Vedic mantras. They merely revealed them for the benefit of all, Srila Prabhupada explains. Regarding your first question, who is the speaker of Ishopanishad? The speaker is the Vedas personified. In the Vedic age, a disciple heard from the spiritual master messages which were coming down into simple succession. So a disciple, whatever he heard from his bona fide spiritual master, would recite. The Vedic mantras are known as Shruti, to hear from authoritative source and then repeat it, chanting. So there is no question of who wrote it. It is said that no human being has compiled them. Later on, before the beginning of Kali Yuga, all Vedic mantras were written in books. Most of them were done by Srila Vyasadeva Mahamuni and his different disciples. Letter to Chitshukananda, 74:28. The Vedas are called Shruti, which means that which what is heard. The word strotra means ear. The Vedas have been handed down orally from generation to generation, have not been taught or learnt from any written text. In the previous ages, the Brahmanas were so intelligent, they were able to remember and understand the Vedic mantras just by listening them from the Guru. 5,000 years ago, Srila Vyasadeva could see that the intelligence of the people living in Kali Yuga will decrease, and therefore he divided the unified Veda. Quote, originally the Veda is one, but Srila Vyasadeva divided the original Veda into four, namely Sama, Yajur, Rig, and Atharva. And then again, they were explained in different branches, like the Puranas and the Mahabharata, Srimad Bhagavatam 1.3.21. Thus, the great sage Vyas, who was very kind to the ignorant masses, edited the Vedas so that they might be assimilated by less intellectual men, Srimad Bhagavatam 1.4.24. Srila Vyasadeva entrusted the different branches of the Vedas to his disciples. All these learned scholars, in their turn, rendered their entrusted Vedas unto their many disciples, grand disciples, and great grand disciples. And thus the respective branches of the followers of the Veda came into being. 1.4.23. At the end of every Dwapara Yuga, there is a different Vyas who divides the Vedas for the benefit of the less intelligent men. Both Srimad Bhagavatam and Vishnu Purana declare that the present Vyas, Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas, is an incarnation of the Lord. In Sri Vishnu Purana 3.4.2-5, Parasara Muni says, then during the period of the 28th Manu, the great master, my son Vyas, divided the one Veda with four divisions into four separate books. Notice here he says, one Veda has four divisions. He makes that into four separate books. Because you're having the Rig, which is the hymn. All the other parts are based on that. Then from that you get the Yajus, which will be the prose aspects that you'll use for performing yajnas and sacrifices. You get the Saman, which is used to glorify and all that. Then there are sub details of it, technicalities and that you get in the Yajurveda. In the Atharvaveda. So those are all together. So to make it more clear, he divided it into these four separate categories. So they're all the same thing is in one place. In the same way, he, as he, the brilliant editor of the Vedas, arranged their entire text into various books. So have other Vyasas in the past, including myself. O best of Brahmanas, you can understand that thus in each of the rotations of the cycle of four ages, a different Vyas organizes the branches of the Vedas. But know that Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas is the Supreme Lord Narayan himself. Who else on this earth, Maitreya, could be the author of the Mahabharata? So this Krishna Dvaipayana then is special because he's saying he's directly the Lord himself. Otherwise, how could he have written the Mahabharata? Because the Mahabharata is you're taking the essence out of all the Vedic literatures, putting them in one place, right? And adding to it other things that aren't even brought out in the Vedas. Right down. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated, thereafter, in the 17th incarnation of Godhead, Sri Vyasa appeared in the womb of Satyavati through Parasara Muni. And he divided the one Veda into several branches and sub-branches, seeing that the people in general were less intelligent. The language of the Vedas, Sanskrit, is known as the language of God and the demigods. Srila Prabhupada's letter to Madhusudan. Srila Prabhupada translates the word Sanskrit as the most perfect. It's interesting to note that the Sanskrit word for something, exactly, it's not just you call it that, its root and how it's derived and everything actually explains the thing that it's dealing with. Does that make sense? It's not that, you know, you call this paper, but why is paper, you know, who knows, you know, where that came from. But this is that the actual word itself is non-different than the qualities of what it describes. That's why it's considered, as one would say, the most perfect. Because in other words, it exactly means you have rasa, you want to explain something. So that rasa means you're going to have to describe verbs and nouns and their interaction. So it must be able to do that exactly, otherwise how do you express what you feel? Unless it can do that. Right? So the broad range that is there in actual human experience, then other languages can't deal with. They don't have the vocabulary, they don't have the grammar, they don't have the roots to do it so perfectly. They can do quite a nice job, but Sanskrit is just most perfect. It just has a word. Like, how do you explain Atman in English? Right? You have to explain so much more. But here, just one word, or bhava. Right? So then it's hard. Bhava is, you know, the experience, but specifically it's also, we generally mean spiritual, because bhava means the material experience. Right? Does that make sense? But it's based off of bhava. But same time, bhava can be generic, just meaning any kind of emotional experience. But when we discuss mundane, generally we use bhava instead of bhava, like that. So it's just so perfect. It exactly says what you want. Like that. Okay, quote. Yeah. Sanskrit is the origin of all languages of the civilized peoples. It is most perfect, not only descriptive. The word Sanskrit means the most perfect, because not a single word you can pronounce without having a bona fide principle. Right? Because even the roots, then, you know, there's something there. There's some proper element of the Vedic philosophy and culture that's being brought out by each word, right? Let alone. That's why Jiva Goswami then can take the first verse of the Bhagavatam and break it apart syllable by syllable and show the chronological in that same verse that we know. It gives the chronological revelation of all of the major pastimes that Krishna will perform. If you break it up by syllables. Like that. So it's just so perfect. At the same time, it also explains what we know of it. Like that. So that's the meaning of says each. It can be, everything is a principle. Like that. At the same time as it may be describing a detail in language we can understand. But everything about it is all the principles behind it, like that, what's happening. So therefore, it's perfect. Sanskrit language is not a result of casual convention between people. It is a reproduction in sound of the structure of reality. As a contemporary scholar admits, quote, Sanskrit words were not just arbitrary labels assigned to phenomena. They were the sound forms of objects, actions, and attributes, related to the corresponding reality in the same way as visual forms, and different only in being perceived by the ear, not the eye. Thomas J. Hopkins, as quoted in Sonic Theology by Guy L. Beck. Okay. Guy Beck. Manusamhita 121 states, Lord Brahma learned the names of various objects and the duties of various classes of people from the words of the Vedas, and thus he could propagate the manifest divisions of names and duties. Right? So from what the Vedas is calling them, he could understand because he understood the language. So he could understand what's the actual nature of something by the word that describes it. Because everything goes back. Everything has meaning you can take back to the root. And then as it unfolds, that root by applying the grammar, then from there you get your what is it, prakriti? Your root word. From the root you get the root word, and then from that you add on other things so you actually get the usable word in the context that you want to apply it. So he could understand all that, so therefore just by studying the words of the Veda, he could understand the whole creation. Right? And so that all came from the Gopal, the Kama Gayatri. Right? So then that, you can understand the whole Veda by understanding that mantra. Because that will give the actual perspective on how all the other mantras, what they're actually meaning. You know, like we were reading, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is quoting from Upanishads, you know, about Radha and Krishna and their pastimes and different things like that. But normally people won't take them in that way. They'll always take it as, you know, Brahman understanding or Paramatma understanding, you know, or Narayan understanding, you know, Lakshmi Narayan, but very, you know, not Radha and Krishna. In his Harinamamrita, Vyakaran Srila Jiva Goswami states, the Sanskrit Narayanad Udbhuto Yam Varnakramaha. The Sanskrit letters originate from Narayana. When properly chanted, the Vedic mantras have the power to manipulate the physical reality in miraculous ways. Lord Brahma was able to accomplish the great task of creating the universe by the power of the Vedic mantras. In ultimate sense, the Vedas are divine personalities who are personal associates of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They eternally reside in the abode of the Lord. From Srimad Bhagavatam we learn that before the creation, the personified Vedas woke up Lord Mahavishnu by offering him prayers. Quote, Sri Sanandana replied, after the Supreme Lord withdrew the universe he had previously created, he lay for some time as if asleep, and all his energies rested dormant within him. When the time came for the next creation, the personified Vedas awakened him by chanting his glories, just as the poets serving a king approach him at dawn and awaken him by reciting his heroic deeds. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.87, 12, and 13. So it means before the creation, the Vedas were there. So the personified Vedas, then they speak. That's why it said the Bhagavatam, it's how do you say? Or its whole source is the prayers of the personified Vedas. Because they are the Vedas. And so then their prayers, from that all the other aspects are being explained through there. Right? And that is being based or explained through the medium of the Chaturshloki. So all those aspects of the personified Vedas are explaining in that chapter, then that taking the perspective of the Chaturshloki, so you make sure you always get it, you know, in a very concise way, then the whole Bhagavatam is expanded. The Samhitas. Let us now take a closer look at the four Vedas. Although eternal, they enter the material world periodically at the beginning of each day of Brahma when one Veda appears from each of his four mouths. When Lord Brahma first spoke the four Vedas with his four mouths, the mantras were mixed together like an unassorted collection of various types of jewels. Srila Vyasadeva sorted the Vedic mantras into four divisions. Samhitas, which thus became the recognizable Rig, Atharva, Yajur, and Samavedas, Srimad Bhagavatam 12.6.50 purport. According to Muktikopanishad, originally the four Vedas had 21, 109, 1,009 branches, respectively, or in total 1,130 branches, shakas. Every branch of the Vedas consists of four parts, Samhita, Brahmana, Aranyaka, and Upanishad. Consequently, there were originally 1,130 Samhitas, 1,130 Brahmanas, Aranyakas, and Upanishads. By the influence of time, however, many texts have been lost. When we speak about... So in here is why you end up with these different shakas, because you have in Sanskrit grammar, you have options how you could pronounce something. Options on how you could emphasize things of that. It'll still mean the same thing. It's just how it will be chanted. So then, depending upon the particular sage who is the head of the particular shaka, then he would prefer a particular combination of grammatical rules. Therefore, it would come out slightly different in the way it would be chanted than another. So this way, then you get all these variety like that. So then, rig. I think Rig had 21. 1,000 is the Samaveda. Like that. Now there's only three left. The Samaveda. And then others, there's just a few left. Like that. Taittiriya Shaka. Not sure what else is there. But that's the most popular. Most of the mantras that you hear, like on tapes from South, or what we chant, that's Taittiriya Shaka. Like that. When we speak about one of the four Vedas, we actually mean its Samhita part only. For example, if we have a book which contains just the Samhita part of the Rig Veda, the book will be called Rig Veda. So when we mention a particular Veda in the paragraph below, we mean its Samhita part. The word Samhita means systematized and collected together. The Samhitas are the main parts of the Veda. They consist of mantras dedicated to different demigods. But if you have the Brahmana section, that will be called the Brahmana, right? Aranyaka, Upanishad. But if you have the Samhita, you'll call that the Veda, because the other three are based on those verses. Now, you have the Rig Veda verse, then how to use that Rig Veda verse in the Yajna, that's called the Brahmana. What are the metaphysics of it? You know, it's what is the metaphysical purpose of that particular ritual or the mantra itself? And its connection, you know, bridging between the physical and the spiritual, that'll be called the Aranyaka. And then the Upanishad will be dealing with the philosophical understanding of that same verse. So that way you'll get it. So the Samhita is the main part of the book. These others are then how you are going to apply them in ritual, metaphysics, and philosophy. The word Rik means stotra or hymn. Rig Veda consists mainly of hymns invoking the demigods like Indra, Agni, Surya, Marut, and Rudra. Rig Veda starts and ends with Shuktas glorifying Agni. There are also Agni Mi'ile, that's the first word. There are also some stories including a narration of Lord Vamanadeva. In Rig Veda, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is glorified in the Purusha Shukta, which appears in the 90th chapter of the 10th mandala. It is said that Purusha Shukta is the original Vedic hymn from which all the Vedas emanate. It is the standard prayer demigods recite to please Lord Mahavishnu. In the famous verse from Rig Veda, it is stated, Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Param Sada Pashyanti Surayaha Devi Vachakshura Atatam. The personality of Godhead Vishnu is the absolute truth, whose lotus feet all the demigods are always eager to see. Like the sun god, he pervades everything by the rays of his energy. He appears impersonal to imperfect eyes. Rig Veda Samhita 1:20-22. Modern Indologists often assert that Rig Veda is the oldest of all Vedas. This is not accepted by the followers of the Vedic tradition. The Vedas are eternal, and thus there is no need to endeavor to prove which one came first. Moreover, in Rig Veda itself, Yajur Veda and Samaveda are mentioned in several places. they all are overlapping. It means every Samaveda mantra then has a rik that it's based on. Right? It's the same Rig Veda rik, like that, but then they do the sam on it, they do the song on it. So you always have the original, and then how the song expands from there, the prayer expands from there. Okay. So then we'll end here, we'll continue. Today's Monday, yeah, tomorrow. Okay.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaur Premanandi.
Okay.
So they're talking about that.